Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today? Well, it's pretty laser-focused and, honestly, financially critical. We're aiming to give you a real shortcut, a definitive guide to picking the right location for investment property. Because, look, you already know location drives value more than almost anything else. But that difference between just average returns and truly transformative wealth, that comes down to knowing precisely how to spot potential before everyone else piles in.
And that's really where we jump in today. We're trying to move past the obvious stuff, you know, like just a low purchase price or maybe a high occupancy rate right now. We want to dig into the factors that actually ensure long-term stable growth. We have to weigh those, let's call them unseen variables, things like future infrastructure plans, the kind of jobs being created, neighborhood development cycles, and something often missed, the regulatory landscape. These details, well, they're the economic foundation. They're what separates a property that steadily goes up in value from one that just becomes a drag on your portfolio.
Okay, right. Let's unpack that a bit. We're not just talking abstract strategy here. We're talking specific metrics, specific research methods that our sources really highlighted. So smart investors, they don't guess, do they? They look at what? Four key fundamentals, things that pretty much guarantee a location can sustain value and growth. Like, decades down the line. Let's start with the big one, the absolute engine, economic growth and jobs.
Well, the basic idea is obvious, right? No jobs, no tenants, simple. But the nuance here is fascinating. Not all job creation is, well, equal. You see cities or regions growing in high-wage sectors, think tech, healthcare, specialized manufacturing, they generate tenants with better income stability. And that supports higher rents and higher property values, low-wage service jobs. Sure, it's growth, but it might just increase the number of tenants without really boosting those rental yield averages much.
That makes a lot of sense. Quality over just quantity. But how do we use simple numbers, simple metrics, to figure out if a region is, you know, about to hit that upward curve?
We need to look at specific population dynamics. Mm-hmm. Our sources suggest targeting regions, maybe cities, that are exceeding, say, a 1.5% annual population growth rate. That specific number, 1.5%, that often marks the point where demand really starts to outstrip the existing rental supply. Mm-hmm. And that creates intense pressure on rents and speeds up property value appreciation. So if the right kind of jobs are there and the population is flowing in at that rate or higher, you're likely looking at a strong market.
Okay, and this is where it gets really interesting for me. Infrastructure and connectivity. People aren't just buying four walls and a roof, they're buying convenience and access.
Exactly. Being close to reliable transport, good schools, modern healthcare, decent shopping centers, that's just table stakes now for desirability. But the real insight, that comes from being proactive with your research. You need to look at future development plans. Are you actually tracking the local government's capital improvement plan? You should be watching for specific public works budgets, money allocated to new metro lines, highway expansions, maybe even those major infrastructure gateway or MIG zoning changes. Buying property near a confirmed future transport link, that can push values up long before the first shovel hits the ground. You basically capture that value premium early.
Right, so it's about buying into the promise of future connectivity almost. Using public documents as your crystal ball, in a way. But sometimes, huge infrastructure projects just flood an area with new buildings, which brings us right to supply and demand. How do we gauge that balance practically? What numbers should we be watching?
Yeah, you need actionable data here. You gauge the rental market's health by tracking vacancy rates. A healthy, balanced market often sits between, say, 5% and 7% vacancy. If that rate drops way below 5%, okay, that signals high demand, potential for rent hikes, good sign. But if it climbs up towards 10%, that's a warning light. The market might be oversupplied, which could push rents down. And sophisticated investors, they look beyond just construction permits. They analyze net absorption. Are new units actually being rented out as fast as they're finished? If you see tons of construction but low net absorption, that's a red flag. Could be a temporary localized bubble.
Okay, and finally, we have to touch on the, sometimes boring but incredibly impactful world of regulations and taxes. This stuff can literally redefine your profit margin.
It really can. And it raises a crucial question. Have you factored in the local legal climate? Or even hostility. Rules and property taxes vary wildly. I mean, think about the contrast. Some cities offer tax breaks, abatements, incentives for certain types of housing. They want investment. Then you have other places with strict rent control, high transfer taxes, maybe really tough ownership laws. Those can just crush your cash flow and scare off long-term money. knowing that local political and regulatory environment up front, it avoids those nasty surprises that can make a great yield just vanish.
Okay, so with those fundamentals laid out, we can now apply that thinking to specific assets. Let's start with residential property. That's usually the entry point for most investors, right? Consistent demand, generally easier to grasp. Where are the high yield spots hiding in today's residential market?
Well, sure. The major urban centers, the big employment hubs, the university towns, they offer reliability. But they often come with really high entry prices and, frankly, lower cap rates. So savvier investors, they might be focusing more on, say, B or C class properties within those urban cores. These are assets often overlooked by the big institutional players. They present really strong opportunities for quick renovation flips or value add strategies to boost the rent roll quickly.
But that explosive potential, the really dramatic growth, often seems to lie in those emerging suburbs, areas on the edges of growing metro areas. You get much lower initial purchase prices there, but there's a timeline risk, isn't there?
That's the critical point you're making there. We need to kind of push back on this idea of guaranteed growth in those areas. When you're looking at an emerging suburb, you have to assess the maturation timeline. Seriously, are we talking 5 years where big retail chains and transit links are already confirmed? Or is it more like a 15-year gamble that relies on speculative rezoning? That's very different. Look for hard evidence, corporate relocations, significant retail anchor tenants actually moving in. Those are the signs that the area is truly shifting from just a bedroom community to, well, a self-sustaining economic hub.
And we can't ignore the lifestyle factor either. Coastal spots, places near natural attractions, they're always popular. Driven by retirees, maybe tourism?
Absolutely. They offer excellent potential for short-term rentals, you know, tourism-driven income, especially with platforms like Airbnb. But be warned that strategy needs intensive professional management, and it exposes you to regulatory changes around short-term rentals. Local governments can change those rules with very little notice. And for the more adventurous listeners, yeah, international hotspots offer portfolio diversification, provided the region shows solid political stability, clear tax treaties, and it's legally straightforward for foreigners to own property and get their money back out.
That's a perfect transition into commercial property.
Yeah.
For serious long-term diversification, commercial feels almost like a necessity. It usually needs a bigger upfront investment, true, but it typically delivers steadier income through longer leases.
Yeah.
So what are the distinct drivers for the main commercial types?
Yeah, and we have to remember, commercial property is analyzed differently. You're using metrics like capitalization rates, cap rates, which gauge expected returns, and you're really diving into the nuances of lease structures.
Can you detail those four main types for us and highlight the key, maybe more technical, investment points for each?
Sure. Let's break it down. One. Office buildings. You're looking at central business districts or maybe suburban campuses with great connectivity. Crucially, assess the building quality. Class A buildings get the best, most reliable long-term tenants. Look for long-term triple net or NNN leases. That's where the tenant covers taxes, insurance, and maintenance. It really reduces the landlord's operational risk. Two, retail spaces. Location is king here, obviously. But the analysis is about tenant mix and foot traffic. Are there anchor tenants like grocery stores drawing reliable crowds? Retail often uses shorter leases. That means cash flow can be less stable, but it does allow you to adjust rents more often based on how the local economy is doing. Three, industrial warehouses. This sector's just exploded thanks to e-commerce. You need to be near major highways, railways, ports. Those logistics hubs are gold. Technical things to look for. Clear height requirements. That's the usable inside vertical space. Modern e-commerce needs heights over 30 feet, and you need large loading bay capacity. Demand is high. Leases tend to be medium to long term. And four, mixed-use developments. These blend residential, office, retail. They diversify your income streams, which is great. They offer protection because, say, a downturn in office space might be offset by stability in the residential units. But the management complexity goes way up. You need specialized teams for that.
And you mentioned leases and tenants, a crucial point for managing commercial risk. Seems to be focusing intensely on that lease structure and tenant quality.
Absolutely critical. You have to decide. Do you want predictable cash flow? That means longer leases, maybe 10, 15-year NNN leases. Or do you want operational flexibility? Shorter leases let you raise rents more often. And prioritizing high-quality, nationally recognized tenants. That significantly cuts your risk of vacancy, late payments, and frankly, the huge costs involved in tenant fit-outs when they eventually leave.
Okay, so whether we're eyeing a B-class apartment flip or maybe a big new logistics center, the question is still, where do we focus our research efforts? Our time, our money. Local markets seem attractive just because of familiarity, right? You know, the legal stuff, the tax schedule. It's easier to physically check things out, manage the property. And you also have direct access to things like local bank lending activity. That's often a key tell for market confidence, sometimes even before property values move.
Right, and if we connect that to the bigger picture, well, international markets offer huge benefits for diversification. You're spreading your regulatory risk, your economic risk across different places. They can also sometimes offer dramatically higher yields or faster appreciation than maybe your mature home market. But, and it's a big but, the complexity just skyrockets. It requires really rigorous research.
So what are those key challenges for investing internationally that we must research, going beyond just political stability?
We need specifics, exactly. You have to dig into foreign ownership laws.
Hmm.
Are non-residents restricted in what they can actually buy? Sometimes they are. Then there's the complexity of local taxation, and critically, how double taxation treaties affect your profits when you bring them home, when you repatriate them. Furthermore, you absolutely must calculate and try to mitigate the costs that come with currency exchange and just general volatility. A fantastic yield overseas can be completely wiped out by a bad currency swing.
Okay, practical question then. If I'm interested in an international hotspot, let's say, somewhere like Vietnam or Portugal, and I'm just starting my research, how do I practically check those foreign ownership laws, those tax implications, without immediately spending thousands on specialized international lawyers?
That's a really good, necessary question. Start with government resources. Many foreign trade departments or national investment agencies, they publish simplified guides aimed at foreign direct investment, or FDI. Look for international property portals, too, the ones that cater specifically to foreign buyers. They often flag major restrictions early on. And you should also consider consulting with specialized international accounting firms. They usually offer introductory consultations about tax treaty impacts before you have to fully commit to hiring a local legal team. Doing that initial legwork helps screen out the impossible places before you sink major professional fees into it.
So whether it's local or international, the toolkit boils down to the same thing. Rigorous research.
Correct. Use those online property portals, sure, but then you have to verify that data against official government statistics, population trends, employment figures, housing supply permits. Align yourself with multiple reputable local real estate agents. Get a consensus view of what's happening on the ground, and keep checking those local planning and zoning meetings to get ahead of the infrastructure changes we talked about earlier. You know, even if you manage to nail the location selection every single time, relying only on physical real estate, it's still risky. Real estate is inherently illiquid. You can't just sell it instantly if you need cash. And it's highly susceptible to local economic downturns, sudden regulatory shocks like unexpected new property taxes. Diversification isn't just nice to have. It's really the necessary shield to protect your returns and ensure more consistent overall growth when one market inevitably takes a dip.
Right. So we need strategic ways to complement those property holdings. The classic approach is balancing that illiquidity and long appreciation cycle with assets you can trade more easily, like stocks and bonds.
Exactly. Equities, stocks, they offer potential for more aggressive capital growth. That balances out the often slower, longer cycle of real estate appreciation. And bonds, especially short to medium-term corporate or government bonds, they provide predictable, stabilizing income. That's crucial for cash flow if property income dips, or maybe when you're funding a big renovation.
And we should probably also consider alternative assets, because they offer non-correlation, which is really the holy grail of true diversification.
Yeah.
Our sources mentioned things like commodities and private equity. Why do those specifically help balance out property ups and downs?
Well, commodities, for example, often act as a hedge against inflation. And since real estate costs, construction, labor, land are directly tied to inflation, holding commodities can provide a sort of counter-cyclical balance when your property ownership costs are spiking. Private equity, on the other hand, gives you exposure to high-growth companies that aren't publicly traded. They operate on completely different business cycles than the housing market, so that further shields your total portfolio if there's a localized real estate downturn.
And we have to talk about the practical side, the management burden. If an investor is building a portfolio, adding commercial properties, maybe diversifying geographically, that management load just explodes, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And that's where specialized investment platforms can be a really efficient solution. Platforms like Gamma Assets, for instance, they can complement your direct property holdings. They provide access to diversified real-world asset-backed investments, often things like infrastructure projects, specialized lending, certain commercial sectors. These can deliver robust income streams without you having to take on the direct management headaches or the liquidity risk that comes with owning yet another physical asset yourself.
Okay, and finally, before anyone rushes out to execute a strategy, we need to remind you, the listener, to take a really deep inventory of your personal situation. Assess your actual risk tolerance, clearly define your investment timeline, your horizon, and verify the liquidity needs and the ongoing management requirements for every single asset type you consider adding. You really need a mix that works for your life, your goals. Hashtag Shag outro. So, to wrap up our deep dive today, smart property investment, it's clearly far more complex than just finding a cheap house somewhere. It really requires a mix of deep, proactive research, using those forward-looking metrics on population growth, infrastructure plans, and just a relentless focus on economic fundamentals. Whether you're targeting a high-demand urban apartment or a complex industrial warehouse, that location must support your long-term wealth strategy.
And remember that true resilience, that strength in your portfolio, it's achieved through strategic diversification. Choosing the right property location, that's just step one. Balancing that inherent illiquidity and localized risk with non-correlated assets like stocks, bonds, or even specialized asset-backed platforms that provides the necessary protection against unpredictable market swings. So here's a final provocative thought for you to chew on. When you compare a residential property, which benefits from pretty consistent, stable population demand, with commercial industrial property, whose growth is increasingly tied to, frankly, volatile, quick-turn logistics and e-commerce trends, what specific historical performance trends, or maybe correlation data, particularly around interest rate sensitivity and technological disruption, should you be researching right now to truly manage future volatility across your entire portfolio?